It is Friday, January the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the U.S. making big changes in its support of a fund for Palestinians.
This is a fund that provides emergency relief, health care, education for 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, but not only, also in Lebanon, in Syria, and one of the U.S. key partners in the region, Jordan.
U.S. diplomats quitting the Myanmar advisory panel, emerging African economies, plus who's retiring in the world of music.
When they disrespect them.
Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has accused the Palestinians of disrespecting the U.S. by refusing to meet with U.S. Vice President Mike Pence during his recent visit to the Middle East. Mr. Pence's willingness to meet with Palestinian leaders was rebuffed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in response to Mr. Trump's December decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
When they disrespected us a week ago by not allowing our great vice president to see them, and we give them hundreds of millions of dollars in aid and support, tremendous numbers, numbers that nobody understands. That money is on the table, and that money is not going to them unless they sit down and negotiate peace.
In recognition of Jerusalem, President Trump also said the U.S. would open a small embassy in the Old City next year. His meeting on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a close U.S. ally, was the first since Mr. Trump announced earlier this month that he would recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The declaration delighted Netanyahu and outraged Palestinians. VOA's Lori London asked Shira Efron, RAND Corporation policy researcher and special advisor on Israel and Iran, for her take on President Trump's comments.
This threat to cut additional funding to the Palestinians comes after last week the United States actually had already reduced aid to the Palestinians. It reduced specific aid that goes to a UN fund that provides assistance to Palestinian refugees. It's called UNRWA. The United States pledged for $125 million and sent only $60 million instead. The U.S. has been the single largest donor to this fund for 70 years now, and this is a fund that provides emergency relief, health care, education for 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, but not only, also in Lebanon, in Syria, and one of the U.S. key partners in the region, Jordan, a country that its stability is a pillar for national security for the U.S. and for Israel, of course. The additional cut in funding is likely to hurt not only Palestinian refugees, but also 20,000 teachers. Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jordan, students, health clinics, food aid even possibly, or it can affect, depending on which pot of money they decide to cut to the money from, it can come from USAID project in the West Bank also, or assistance to Palestinian security forces, which are in charge of law and order and who partner with Israel in counterterrorism efforts.
Is it just up to the President of the United States, or do you know if this sort of decision about cutting funding needs to go through Congress?
It does need to go through Congress. Congress currently would support this. So, for instance, one of the legislation efforts now, known as the Taylor Force Act, is meant to cut part of the funding for projects in the West Bank, other than in health and water projects. So Congress is already moving along with this process.
What specifically will the lack of funding do? Who will be the most affected by it?
We know from experience that when UNRWA is in a crunch, education tends to get hit first because funding for education is easier to cut than reductions in other areas, food, health, and infrastructure, which could really endanger people's lives very immediately. We'd be talking about some more than 20,000 teachers in the Gaza Strip, mostly in the West Bank, and then also in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. Schools also. Next would come health clinics.
President Trump said in Davos that he did something historic and what no one else would do, which he felt would actually bring Israelis and Palestinians closer to peace, which was to take Jerusalem off the table. Do you agree with that?
This logic is a bit puzzling to me. 6 months before the statement that President Trump made recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, he said that he signed the waiver, which he did in the second time as well, but also saying that the United States will move the embassy in due time, but they want to give it some time to let the peace process develop. So it's hard for me to understand how 6 months later, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and Jerusalem being possibly the thorniest issue between Israelis and Palestinians, removes it off the table. In his statement, the president did acknowledge that by recognizing it as Israel's capital, they don't deliberate on the final borders of the city. The future of the city needs to be further negotiated, which means it continues to be a negotiation issue. Also, we are seeing the implications of that statement since then. The Palestinians basically said that instead of receiving the ultimate deal, they received the ultimate slap in the face, I think was the term they used,
right. And
denouncing the U.S. as not suitable to serve as a mediator between Israelis and Palestinian peace. So clearly, it has not had the effect that the president described.
It seems that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pretty in lockstep with President Trump's policies toward Israel. What does Israel in general think about cutting aid to the Palestinians?
You know, formally, the Prime Minister says that UNRWA perpetuates the Palestinian refugee problem instead of resolving it, and therefore it's good that Nikki Haley and President Trump are cutting aid to this agency. Further, they're adopting the narrative. This is all formally. That the Palestinians are at fault for not coming back to the negotiations table, and you know, using the U.S. leverage of threatening to cut funds could be an effective move. In private, however, and this is important, we hear from officials, serving officials, that they would like to see a gradual decrease in funds. That doing it immediately without preparation could have dangerous implications for security, for human lives in refugee camps where you anyway have marginalized and disadvantaged populations to begin with. This is coming both from the government and from the security services.
Shir Efron is a RAND Corporation policy researcher and special advisor on Israel and Iran. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Former U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson has resigned his position as a member of the International Advisory Board for the Committee for Implementation of Recommendation on Rakhine State in Myanmar, which is also known as Burma. The panel was formed last year to act on a work of commission led by former U.S. Secretary General Kofi Annan to address the violence in western Rakhine State. Richardson said in part what precipitated his action was an argument he got into with the state councilor and de facto Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi about two Reuters journalists on trial for allegedly violating the Official Secrets Act.
She believes there's a concerted international effort against Myanmar, and I believe she is wrong. She blames all the problems that Myanmar is having on the international media, on the UN, on human rights groups, on other governments. And I think this is caused by the bubble that is around her, by individuals that are not giving her frank advice. I also disagree with the direction the chairman, Surakiat, wants to take the advisory board. There's no agenda. There's no plan to address some of the issues relating to safety, to citizenship. I don't want to be part of a whitewash, and I felt it's best that I resign immediately.
Richardson said he was unhappy and distressed by the explosive reaction from Aung San Suu Kyi, who said the case of the journalist was not part of the board's charter. The U.S. called Richardson's action a cause for concern. His departure came a day after Bangladesh and Myanmar failed to meet a deadline to begin the repatriation of some nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled a military crackdown last year in Rakhine. Monique Skidmore is Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Tasmania in Australia and followed very closely events in Myanmar. She tells VOA's Victor Beatty she's not surprised at Richardson's decision.
I am surprised that Aung San Suu Kyi is seeking to so narrowly implement or interpret the recommendation of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's report on the causes and changes required to bring back transparency and security in Rakhine State.
Are you saying she's not fully embracing those recommendations?
The committee itself hasn't made any recommendations as to how to implement the former report, but clearly Aung San Suu Kyi is trying to deal with it in a logistical way, in a way that has to do with aid, rather than moving into any of the areas that include national security. And that's going, and really that means that that Governor Bill Richardson may be right. This may end up being a whitewash if it continues to not tackle the underlying causes, as Kofi Annan very clearly spelled out, that are leading the Rohingya to leave in such numbers.
Richardson said Aung San Suu Kyi lacks moral leadership. Is that a surprising statement?
No, it's not a surprising statement. I suppose it's surprising to all of us who've followed Myanmar for so many years that Aung San Suu Kyi has taken such a weak role in this, that this is not an issue that she has ever spoken strongly about. Even when she accepted her Nobel Peace Prize, she simply spoke about the Rohingya as communal unrest. She's never shown leadership on this issue. And whilst we all understand the complexities of the emerging transition to democracy, the rise of Buddhist fundamentalism, the importance and the critical role that the military still has under the constitution, there still truly has been a complicity by Aung San Suu Kyi, which of course is disappointing for everyone who's ever known her.
What does his resignation from this board do to its final report?
It won't do anything at the moment other than further diminish its credibility. We need to see if any other members resign, and we need to see if any recommendations are implemented from Kofi Annan's report. Otherwise, it will be a whitewash. Hopefully, what's happened with Governor Bill Richardson resigning is that he is shining the spotlight back on Aung San Suu Kyi, increasing the pressure, and further increased pressure internationally can only be a good thing for the people of Rakhine State.
Monique Skidmore is the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Tasmania in Australia. She said she has little faith the proposed repatriation of the Rohingya back to Myanmar will ever take place, since many are still waiting for a chance to return from previous repatriation programs. She also said there is no evidence villages destroyed in the crackdown are being rebuilt, enough transition camps set up, and changes to the regulations governing the Muslim minority, such as citizenship, freedom of movement, employment, and marriage. A global trade finance company is providing short-term financing for entrepreneurs in Africa who cannot get enough money elsewhere to cover the cost of purchasing goods. Countable, a multinational technology and trading company headquartered in the U.S. city of San Francisco, California, also has offices in Mauritius, Kigali, Rwanda, as well as Grand Cayman, and will soon have an office in Nairobi, Kenya. Chris Hale is the company's CEO, and he spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about how this company is helping entrepreneurs in Africa make dreams come true.
Countable is a global trade platform, and we offer a unique type of finance for entrepreneurs who are importing, where we buy goods on their behalf and help them execute on international trade deals.
What are the qualifications for getting financing, especially if an entrepreneur has been turned down by a bank?
We look at the trade transactions very differently. We're not really assessing the creditworthiness of the entrepreneur. We're looking at the quality of their end customer, the quality of their supplier, and their ability to execute on the transaction. So we're able to look at the problem very differently than banks and assess those qualifications based on how well the deal will go and how likely we think it is to execute.
What would be an example?
We do a lot of work in IT. And so an entrepreneur wins a contract to build a data center for a bank, as an example. And they need to buy all the components of the data center, like, you know, switches and cabling and so forth. And the bank wants it to be first quality, top tier equipment, like Cisco, as an example. And so the entrepreneur has difficulty getting that financed because it's a large deal. Big companies like Cisco aren't going to ship to a small business without getting paid. And the bank won't pay until the project is complete. And so there's quite a lot of friction in that three-party transaction, but we understand it and can help make it run smoothly.
And how are you able to help finance these types of businesses?
So over the course of our lifetime as a company, the answer to that question was varied. But as of January last year, we secured a $150 million line of credit from an investment fund here in the United States. And so we use that capital to fund these projects.
When you're looking at entrepreneurs in Africa, what are some of their biggest challenges?
I think the biggest challenge these entrepreneurs in Africa face is anonymity. People have a lot of assumptions about what business is like in Africa, and frankly, those assumptions are often underdeveloped. And the entrepreneurs have no formal way to demonstrate their identity, both as a safe counterparty to work with and as a good business partner to engage with. And so our platform manages their identity and assesses their readiness for this project.
Can you give us an example of a success story from your experiences in working with African entrepreneurs?
Sure. One of my favorite recent success stories is we were contracted with a small entrepreneur that we've worked with on five different occasions now to procure almost $1 million worth of malarial test kits from a subsidiary of Abbott. That program is facilitated by the World Health Organization. So one would think that a project of this magnitude and importance would work a little bit better than it does. But even these really critical development projects face this problem. And it really gives us a lot of pride to be able to make those kinds of projects work better.
That is Chris Hale. He is CEO of the global trade finance company Countable. And he was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Yes, indeedy, VOA News. You can find us there. Perfect website, voanews.com. Hey, listen, we should move along and find out what's trending on social media. VOA's Doug Bernard here with what's happening. What you got, Doug?
Well, you know, there's a rather grim story. I don't know to the degree that you've been covering it. This involves a physician in Michigan, Dr. Larry Nassar. He was convicted of many instances of sexual abuse when he was not just a physician working at Michigan State, but also working for the U.S. gymnastics team, the U.S. Olympic women's gymnastics team. And he has been sentenced. The fallout has now reached to the MSU president, Luann Simon, who has stepped down from her role as president. But the anger really only seems to be growing out there. The hashtag Larry Nassar is really it's fascinating to read. I'm just going to go through a couple of these here. One, first off, this is Regina Vadayatham, who is a BBC reporter. She tweets out here, "While in the toilets, I heard a woman sobbing uncontrollably in the stall next to me. I asked if she was okay. She told me she testified earlier. Don't forget how hard it must be for these young women not only to relive their ordeal, but to do so in front of their abuser. Of course, one of the aspects of the sentencing portion of this trial of Dr. Larry Nassar was the judge allowed victims to come forward and address the court and, you know, in so doing, address Dr. Nassar himself. And it's really been a grim parade. The numbers are unbelievable. Here's Ryan Schilling. Larry Nassar is now the most prolific child molester in American history. He's currently, the number for Nassar now exceeds 180. It's impossible to believe, but 180 young women have come forward and said that he sexually abused them. This is Caitlin Flynn, also herself a journalist. Never forget that U.S. Gymnastics allowed Larry Nassar to, quote, treat their athletes for 2 years while he was under criminal investigation. He was actually under investigation for alleged sexual harassment, and U.S. Gymnastics kept him on the staff and allowed him to continue, you know, examining or working with the young athletes. So anger is really now pointing at the U.S. gymnastics team and the U.S. Olympic Committee. I mean, people are very angry. You can understand why. And they're really asking for heads to roll, you know, all the way up to, you know, the head of U.S. Olympic Committee. So it's a grim read, but it's fascinating, and it's got a lot of people talking out there.
No doubt. Many thanks, Doug. VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Nora Poihonen holds a glass filled with 70 crickets.
Our cricket bread, as sirkkaleipä as we call it, it's hand-baked artisan bread.
You heard that right. Bread made out of crickets, which Poihonen, the marketing and portfolio director of Finland food company Fazer, says is the first company to sell insect bread.
The insects are ground, so and they are baked there with the flour, so you don't really see or feel them at all in the bread.
She says some people drive 100 kilometers to buy a loaf at $4.75. Others, like shopper Mark Russell, are wary of insect bread, but he says
it tastes really good.
Insects are filled with vitamins, iron, and calcium, and the trend is catching on in Europe now in places like Britain, Denmark, and Belgium, selling insects to eat and food made with insects. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, it turns out that three major music artists have announced retirements this week after decades of performing. VOA's Jim Stevenson and Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald talk about these closing acts on the, as the curtain comes down a bit differently for each one.
Yesterday's songs don't seem to belong. They're here and they're gone. Yesterday's moves don't stay in the grooves. They keep moving on.
You know, for someone who's followed classic rockers for so many decades, it's sometimes a little disheartening, because if they're not dying, they're retiring. But that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Time marches on. And this week, three big acts announced that they are retiring from touring. The big one came on Monday when Neil Diamond said he was hanging it up. On his doctor's orders, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Neil is 77 years old. He canceled the Australian and New Zealand legs of his 50th anniversary tour. He says he will remain active in writing and recording for as long as possible. And one nice result from this announcement is that his fans in New Zealand and Australia have responded by donating the money from their ticket refunds to Parkinson's research and other charities. And Neil has tweeted about that. And I retweeted him on my Twitter feed, Ray on the Hits.
That's great.
So we certainly wish the best for Neil Diamond. And then on Wednesday, Elton John held a press conference saying he was retiring. However, this is going to come after a 3-year farewell tour. Elton says he wants to devote more time to his two young sons. Elton is 71 years old. He will kick off what he says will be his final tour on September 8th in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So I think Elton's leaving himself a little wiggle room here.
I think so.
A lot
can
happen.
We've seen
this
story before with a few artists who kind of toyed with it but kept going.
Haven't we? Yes, we have. Cher, Tina Turner.
Mm-hmm. Still on their farewell tours.
Right. Well, I think Tina pretty much has hung it up. She's living in Switzerland now. As for Cher, who knows what she's going to do. And finally, on Thursday, the members of Lynyrd Skynyrd said they will kick off their farewell tour on May 4th in West Palm Beach in their home state of Florida. It has been 45 years since they released their debut album. That's the one with Freebird on it. Mm-hmm. Lynyrd Skynyrd's best-known lineup ended in 1977 when three members died in a plane crash. Some people think Lynyrd Skynyrd may have broken up at that point. However, they did break up, but they reformed in 1987, and they have continued recording and touring since then. All three of these acts are members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and what can I say? It's sobering to see time marching on.
Catch them while they're out there.
Catch them while you can.
Fantastic.
That's right.
Still,
the clock is ticking on all of us.
We say farewell for the time being to Ray McDonald. He'll be back next week, and you can always catch Ray on Twitter
at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Say goodbye to the tabloids. Say goodbye to Die or So Die. Say goodbye to New Age music from the Kappa to the Coda.
And here's the latest on the Grammys, bumped up a month to account for the upcoming Winter Olympics. This year's Grammy Music Awards this Sunday will be featuring a lot of entertainers, especially hip-hop. Big ones this year, Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar, two of the top nights contenders for the Album of the Year. Big evening coming up. Want to remind you also, you should watch however you can get it. Lots of acts performing: Rihanna, Bruno Mars, Sam Smith, Lady Gaga, Pink, Miley Cyrus, Patti LuPone from a few decades ago, still out there making news, and singing, Elton John, U2, all kind, little big town, and a special tribute to the victims of October's Las Vegas shooting. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains vigilant to prevent Iran from gaining any new ground in the Middle East. Speaking to the Israeli Knesset, Vice President Mike Pence said, "The United States will continue to work with Israel and with nations across the world to confront the leading state sponsor of terror, the Islamic Republic of Iran." The regime in Iran is a brutal dictatorship that seeks to dominate its citizens and deny them their most fundamental rights. History has proven those who dominate their own people rarely stop there, said Mr. Pence. And increasingly, we see Iran seeking to dominate the wider Arab world. The Iranian regime sows chaos across the region. Last year alone, even as its citizens cried out for help with basic necessities, Iran devoted more than $4 billion to malign activities in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere across the region. It has supported terrorist groups that even now sit on Israel's doorstep. The U.S. is working to enact effective and lasting restraints on Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, said Mr. Pence. Earlier this month, the president waived sanctions on Iran to give the Congress and our European allies time to pass stronger measures. But as President Trump made clear, this is the last time. The United States vowed, Vice President Pence, will never allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. Beyond the nuclear deal, we will also no longer tolerate Iran's support of terrorism or its brutal attempts to suppress its own people. To the people of Iran, the U.S. has another message, declared Mr. Pence. We are your friends, and the day is coming when you will be free from the evil regime that suffocates your dreams and buries your hopes. And when your day of liberation finally comes, we say to the good people of Iran, the friendship between our peoples will blossom once again.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.